Hello and welcome to another episode of Stuck at Home. I'm in conversation today with Nick Thompson, who's the editor of Wired Magazine and Wired.com, plus one of the great human beings on the planet and a marathon runner like none other, and an author of an essay which perhaps was one of the best things I've read in recent times. How are you, Nick?
I'm doing well. That was a very kind introduction.
Really? I don't know. This is the first time I've seen you, at least I can see you and other people can't, with a beard, right? Like, you're so clean shaven. And
I know. Well, you know, I've had beards at different points in my life. Probably from 21 to 23 when I was traveling a lot, just because it's hard to shave when you travel, but it's been a while. My hair is getting longer too. You know, I had hair down to my shoulders through most of high school and college. So I'm starting to feel like maybe I'm reverting to my 20s.
But you never left your 20s the way you look. Do I have to say that if the haircut will make for great television on LinkedIn and your Instagram and on your Twitter, I know you're like a social media editor celebrity in my mind, at least.
You know, my ambition in life has always been to be a LinkedIn video celebrity.
Hey, it gets you clicks, nothing like it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the, I wish more editors thought like you, you know, create a bond with the publication, get more people.
I mean, you've got to do it. It's part of the job of being an editor right now is different from what it used to be, right? You can't be just Adam Moss brilliantly staying up all night making sure every word and picture is perfect. Your responsibilities are now like across platforms, talking to the audience, talking to advertisers. There's a whole lot of stuff you have to do now that's different for better or for worse.
Right. How is it, you know, editing in the quarantine? You're like in New York, a lot of your staff is here in the Bay Area. There is time difference. Like, how are you managing to do all that stuff?
It's a lot easier than I expected. So we all went remote in the beginning of March, and it's been a fairly smooth transition, in part because we were already bi-coastal. So we were all used to Zoom meetings anyway. The whole staff would meet by Zoom, half in a room in San Francisco, half in a room in New York, a couple times a day, regardless. So that hasn't been a huge change. No one on the staff has gotten sick. And the story of coronavirus, it's not one where we had to shift our editorial focus to find a way in. You know, we've always covered science and tech. So there were, you know, from the first day that this became a pandemic in the US, there have been 1,000 things you're wired to cover every day.
So are you working at full strength right now? I mean, you know, I've heard that as things have not been all that awesome for other tech and companies, other tech media publications, other media publications. How are things with Wired right now?
Our traffic is really good. Our subscription numbers are really good. Our commerce numbers are really good, and our advertising numbers are not good. So the budget situation, as any reader familiar with the New York Times knows, at Condé Nast is complicated. So part of my job is to manage that.
Man, you know, I'm glad I'm not in the media anymore. I look at all my friends going through so much, you know, ambient stress of like people hating media, people not respecting media, plus all the economic distress people are going through.
Well, this is, you know, it's part of what makes it such a crazy time, where first of all, the work we're doing has never been more important. So, you know, what Wired publishes matters ever more, right? Society needs the right information about how to respond to this crisis, how to create a vaccine, how scientists should collaborate, what research is bull, what research is not, right? That's utterly essential. You know, where can, you know, makers create effective PPE? Where can they not? On the other hand, the financial model is more challenged than ever. And then interestingly, you know, the reputation of the media hasn't seemed to have improved during this crisis. I thought it would. You know, I thought that the anti-media backlash was a function of a lot of factors, but many of which were, you know, tied into the Trump administration and politics. And that once the world was focused on this crisis, and once it depended so much on truthful information, that the backlash would dissipate. And it hasn't. You know, the tech backlash has dissipated. The media backlash seems to still be going strong, I think.
So, you know, how do you overcome that? Like, you know, clearly, I heard from in a conversation today from someone who said, you know, good journalists are essentially historians of the present. Mm-hmm. And I think, wow, what a great way of describing the job, right? More than anything else. And, you know, there is not everybody is doing that. Like, some of them are completely driven by the clickbait and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. You
know, so what is the model in your mind to kind of, you know, not only help the media industry survive and then thrive, and but more importantly, you know, buff the reputation, which seems to be taking a little bit of a lick right now?
Yeah. A lot of hard questions embedded in that. So on the, you know, the most important thing that we've done at Wired and then we did at the New Yorker in my previous job was to shift the economic model so that business is dependent upon subscriptions, not on clicks, right? And once your digital business is dependent on subscriptions, not on clicks, you have a different set of incentives. You hire writers who build loyalty, not writers who can just generate big numbers. The writers, you know, through the ambient effect of all the little incentives that happen in a workplace, you know, train themselves to write stories that generate subscriptions, not just stories that generate clicks. Not like those two things are perpendicular or uncorrelated. Clearly, a story that has a lot of readers will get more subscribers, but there are ways they differ. So that's a helpful thing that can be done both to sustain a publication in the long run and to set up the right incentive system for your writers and your editors. On the question of the industry's reputation, you know, a lot of it has to do with the way that social media refracts information. And a lot of it has to do with just the way people absorb media right now, where they, you know, one reporter from one publication tweets something stupid, and that becomes a stand-in for what the whole media thinks. And the reason that happens is both because, you know, power is dispersed, you know, and fewer people go to the nytimes.com. They go to the New York Times reporter's Twitter feed. So suddenly you're putting the reputation in the hands of 100 people out on Twitter, some of whom have been drinking too much or riled up about whatever. And then secondly, just the way social media works, where when you see something that angers you or confirms a previously held belief, you amplify it, other people see it, it confirms their previously held beliefs, and it starts a cycle. And this happens in sort of all backlashes in all areas, where social media just makes you feel, you know, you suddenly feel like every journalist thinks this, even if, you know, it's one out of 1,000 who's tweeted who actually feels that way. And so that contributes to the backlash. And of course, you know, journalism industry makes lots of mistakes, you know, chases clicks, gets stuff totally wrong, you know, is, you know, extremely anti-Trump, right? 98% of reporters will probably vote for, you know, Joe Biden, whereas 50% of the country will vote for Joe Biden. So there's some real structural problems there. But I also feel like it's because of the social media moment that we live in. A lot of the heat towards our industry comes from the social media moment we live in and the way it's changed power dynamics.
I mean, a lot of it is what I kind of am amazed by the whole thing. It's because social media has helped. You know, I was joking about you being a social media star, but the reality is that a lot of us know you more intimately because of social media. We know you play a guitar. We know you've got the boys. And, you know, there is a lot more to love and be affectionate about a reporter because of the social media in your case. And I think so. It's a double-edged sword, right? Like, I think, you know, what the same social media will give us, it also take us something away. And you know, I think that's somewhere in there is a problem, right? Like, I think, you know, you keep writing about Facebook and all these other social media companies. And I just feel many of them have not, you know, they've been remiss in figuring out that balance. And I think they have not used their technical, you know, powers to find that, you know, fine balance, for lack of a better word, because they've only been devoted to growth and ad revenue growth and not to kind of finding what's the right mix. And I think, you know, maybe I'm being idealistic, but I think as a platform, that's their job.
That is their job. And it is one of the consequences for our industry, for lots of industries, right? So when we talk about the effect of social media on media, people tend to focus on this notion that the social media company stole all the ad revenue, which I think is a little displaced, right? They built a better ad product, and so they figured out a better way of reaching people. And that's capitalism, and that's the way things work. And I would like the media industry to have a larger share of advertising, because I'd like to be able to support Wired's journalism more, but there we are. But I do think that the way that social media has appealed to our worst instincts, the way that social media has built, you know, filter bubbles within filter bubbles within filter bubbles, outrage bubbles within filter bubbles, you know, the incentives for behavior that it has created, where it tends to incentivize, you know, the worst behavior, not the best behavior, where it tends to, you know, strengthen opposition to outgroups. I think that's a serious problem. And I think it's because of the way it was built at the beginning. And exactly as you say, not enough thought was put into the longer term effect on society. But again, also what you said, like, I love social media, right? I'm on it all the time, right? I feel like I can do my little part. I hope to make it better, and I hope to educate myself and to constantly. I had this funny thing yesterday where I realized that one of the ways that I could get sucked into these mobs was through the Twitter trends. And you know, you go on Twitter and you see your friends and you see like you've posted something smart and somebody else has posted a smart chart, and you see Twitter trends, and like you click on one and it's just all these people screaming about the worst possible interpretation of something that happened this day. And so I tweeted, I was like, hey, does anybody have a Chrome plugin that can block this? Like, I just don't want to see it, right? I already mute the word Trump on Twitter. I try to, you know, mute any account that I think is, you know, creating more heat than light. And so I tweeted that. And eventually the solution I led to was changing my location to Honduras. So now all my trends are in Spanish and I don't understand them, but like, at least I feel like I'm slightly building up my vocabulary.
So I wanted to, this is the next question I wanted to ask you. I think this is, you know, again, as you know me well enough, and you edited me at New Yorker and you edited a couple of my pieces at Wired as well. You know, I love technology. I love the possibilities. I love what it means. I love, you know, where it can take us. And yet, when I look at the media, I find many tech writers just dislike technology, or like, that's the feeling I get. All I get this sense is like the hatred for tech. I understand there needs to be checks and balances, but I just don't feel like a little bit that, you know, that balance of like, you know, you gotta love the science and technology. Otherwise, like, why are we doing this? Like, if you're, what's the explanation in your mind?
Well, I don't think reporters dislike tech as much as they're often accused of disliking tech. I would take that as a starting point. So I think Silicon Valley overstates the dislike. That said, I would be lying if I didn't think it was also true. So where does, you know, to a certain degree, so where does that come from? Well, it comes from skepticism of power, right? In general, like, people go into journalism are skeptical of power, and they like to report about what's wrong with power, right? And so in some moments, you know, if I'm a young, acerbic person who's skeptical of power and wants to use the tools of journalism to hold power to account, maybe in the past I would go to Washington and be a political reporter. Maybe today I go to Silicon Valley and become a technology reporter. And so it's less a hatred than a mistrust. And then I think there's two added elements, one of which is there is a little resentment over the sense that the technology industry has, turned journalists into sort of sharecroppers on their industrial farms, right? That Facebook has taken all of the ad market and, forced journalists to be supplicants, and the journalists go to the meetings with the Facebook executives and they're like, these people aren't necessarily smarter than us, or they see their college classmates who went to Facebook, making 50 times as much money. And that creates a certain amount of resentment. So I guess part of it is the nature of the people who go into journalism. Part of it is the nature of the moment we are in right now, where the tech industry has grown fabulously wealthy and the media industry is kind of on the rocks. Those contribute to it. But on the other hand, like at Wired, we try really hard to hire reporters who are skeptical but who love tech. And that's how I think of myself. I wrote all those stories about Facebook not because I wanted to get Mark Zuckerberg. I'm fascinated by Facebook. I think Facebook is one of the most interesting tools for connecting humanity. When Facebook was created, I was like, wow, this is a whole new language that humanity can use. And it's an interesting societal evolution. And then I got frustrated when I saw what had happened in the 2016 election, and that inspired those stories. But I think lots of the best tech reporters genuinely are profoundly interested in tech, love the questions raised by tech, and are also skeptical of power. But I'm going to flip it around. Why do venture capitalists hate tech reporters so much?
I don't know. Which venture capitalists are you talking about? I love tech reporters.
I know. You're the best. You're so nice. You have lists of your favorite tech reporters. You're great.
I just feel like the missing piece, which I struggle with, is that I don't experience the joy of tech in any of the writings when I see from most of the technology. Everything comes with a little bit, like you said, a lot. It used to be a little bit cynicism is good. It's a lot of cynicism. I believe, too much enthusiasm is bad and too much cynicism is bad. And I just think there needs to be a balance somewhere. I was reading something today. I can't remember which newsletter it was. I think it was somewhere. I just said the opening line of that email newsletter was the creators of the digital surveillance state. And I was like, and they were, the person was describing Yelp and Airbnb. And I was just like, wow, that's your baseline to think about this industry, not to mention that the digital surveillance state has existed for a lot longer than we realize, or that in 2001, it was the telephone companies which enabled this. I mean, I just don't understand that. And I think that's what I mean. It's like, how can you be in this industry and that's your baseline of technology coverage? Anyway, I think that's, for me, that is where I kind of feel that there is the two groups might be wide apart. It's like the technology industry insiders, for the lack of a better word, and the reporters, is that there has to be a healthy cynicism and healthy optimism. I think without that, we don't progress. And, we will have these state of affairs the way they are.
I think that's right. I think that is a true point. It is definitely the case. There are many times I read stories from all kinds of different publications and I'm like, it's not quite that. I sometimes think with Facebook that, 5 years ago or 4 years ago, I was considered, or maybe even 2 years ago, I was considered a harsh critic of Facebook. And now I'm considered kind of an apologist. And I feel like my position on Facebook never changed, right? That it's run by reasonably well-intentioned people who are overwhelmed by the task at hand and made a whole bunch of mistakes in how they set up the structural incentives and created a really interesting product that has problems, right? And I feel like I've felt that pretty much the same view for the last 5 years. And initially it was, Nick's like a crazy critic. And now it's like Nick's the last person who will trust anything they say or, think anything positive about something they launch. And that's because of where public opinion and media opinion has shifted.
And I think this is where I have it. Like, again, I'll go back to that point. You know, let's talk about Facebook. I mean, I'm one of the biggest critics of that company, and I have been, and I don't trust that company or the leader of that company. I think if you look at the history of that company, it has been duplicitous and not very good about its ethics from day one, right? Just the history of that company is the guy basically was, there's a lot of murkiness in that company, the way they behaved to his co-founders, yada, yada, yada. So why wouldn't that scale up with success? People don't really change that much. They remain pretty much the same who they are. And they always keep denying. Anyway, this is not about Facebook. My view.
But can we pause here for a second to say we're having a conversation between a venture capitalist and a journalist, and the venture capitalist is hammering the tech industry, and the journalist is defending it. At least Facebook.
I'm a former journalist, so
that's true.
I've been a critic of Facebook since 2007. It's not a fashionable thing for me because I always questioned their motives and how the impact. So this is where I want to go to.
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to make is that if you have healthy skepticism, you know, from day one, and you have healthy optimism from day one, you can actually see where we are going and actually start to question everything from the right, using the right matrix, using the right vector, not like after the fact hating Facebook and 2017 or 2018 is not the point. The damage was done way before that, right? The way to think about Facebook was in 2007, 2008, 2010, where we could actually start to see where the society was headed and how to actually force this company to behave in a more ethical manner. Well, in 2017 or 2018, it's like, it's a little late to kind of start thinking differently. And this is where I feel that, you know, if you're in the tech media, you need to be thinking about like, hey, what's the long-term impact of that?
Like, let's talk about some of the things that we see, we know we're coming, right? We know that the coronavirus crisis is going to create a boon in telemedicine, right? We know that the coronavirus crisis is going to create, it's going to be the moment where online education comes to the fore, right? We've been talking about MOOCs for a decade, but they're actually going to happen, right? We know that it's going to very much change the way the gig economy works, right? We know it's going to completely change the way working from home software works. So let's talk about let's talk about telemedicine. How should we be thinking about it, covering it, writing it to make sure that as it goes through this very sudden transition, it goes in the right direction and is helpful to society as opposed to harmful to society?
Okay, let's step back. Like, what is telemedicine? It's, you know, we've been forced to adopt telemedicine and online education because, you know, parents don't have a choice. I have had 6 appointments with my doctors on telemedicine. I'm looking at this as like...
Really?
Yeah, and I'm just like thinking, why did this not happen earlier? Like, what was the problem? There is nothing, you know, so when you start to think about it, this was just an institutional problem, right? It was like a problem created by, you know, the legislators and the regulators and legal bodies and insurance companies, not the technology. So the technology has existed. So the crisis is removing all those external non-technology barriers. However, going forward, what is the rules and regulations around it? Like, why, how long can the hospitals keep this data, this video recording of our conversation? What is the metadata they are allowed to keep in order to create a profile and, you know, understand like what happened? Because at some point, this is going to become a problem. Some point, an insurance company can get access to my videos and use against me. And my premium goes through the roof, right? I think we should be thinking about not where we are, but where we will be 5 years from now. What are the rules and regulations of an average person? Like, what are the rights of me as a patient you know, in a world where everybody's doing telemedicine, right? So we have HIPAA, which is about not releasing my data to certain parties, but this is also my data. Like, how long can they keep? This is not like, you know, is it for a couple of weeks? Is it a couple of months? Like, what is the information? So I'm thinking about those things going forward. How much do they transcribe? What do they keep? I think those are the challenges of any technology. It's not like building the tech. It's not about using the tech. It's about how do we, you know, how do we frame it for the future? How do we regulate and understand it for the future? You know, unfettered, you know, access to our medical records is also not a good idea, because we know historically the insurance companies have not done the right thing. You know, profit is like a really evil motive at times.
But what if you had the option of having a video recording of every hospital visit you've had since the time you're 18 years old, stored locally, right? And then next time you go see a new doctor, you could have those uploaded, analyzed by an AI, possibly get better treatment. Would you take that, or is the risk too high?
I would take that, but as long as I know what the regulatory boundaries are on that data, like who is it available to? It's the same thing with Facebook, right? Like, I'll go back to Facebook. It's like, yeah, they can have my information, but what can they do with it, right? They failed to protect my data when they gave Cambridge Analytica access to that data. They do that consistently with third-party applications, which have access to Facebook login. So that was dereliction of duty. Now, if you take that even more, my personal medical records, I need to be thinking about, because we know insurance companies can increase the premium if they can use your words against you. That's what I mean. It's like we have to think about technology from an application standpoint, not today, but what it will be 5-10 years from now when it is completely pervasive. So it's the same thing about Facebook. Like, what's the point of complaining about them today when we should have done this in 2008 and could have prevented a lot of that thinking?
I'm super interested in the telemedicine question because, yes, absolutely. You want to design the system so that you minimize the risks and maximize the benefits over a long time horizon. And so one way to think about that is to minimize the risks. Data should be certainly anonymized, potentially deleted. But to maximize the benefits, the data from my conversation with the doctor, whether it's an anonymized transcript, an anonymized video, which wouldn't really do much good unless you blotted out my face or something. The benefits of it, if you can store the data in some way, are fairly high. Right, particularly as new techniques come for understanding how symptoms develop, right? And maybe they're medical things in my past that have come up in conversations with doctors that are now long lost as I switched doctors and lost records. So the optimal solution it is true. A very useful project for a policymaker or a product manager right now in tech working in telemedicine would be to come up with a philosophy on how to set the ground rules, with the understanding that in general, we set these things up to take too much data and then we misuse it.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm pointing to. I'm not saying don't use the technology. I love the idea of telemedicine. Thank God, like finally doctors are using it, that I don't have to go to the hospital and spend, you know, $30 coming and going on Uber to just get a normal, like have a face-to-face conversation.
And it's much more efficient because the doctor can shift from patient to patient without going to the waiting room and calling. And you don't get sick at the hospital.
Yeah. Plus having like a $100 device, which can measure my blood pressure or, you know, all those things we do. It's like, we already have all that data, right? Like just building a more like a better constrained access to that data, which is just between me and the medical professional is a worthy experiment to think about, like in the future. I think is the same thing. You know, what does that robotics delivery in the future mean? Like, I don't know. Like, what does it mean? I don't even know. I can't find a way to think about like the future, because we are still, you know, we've got one leg in the industrial era and we are trying to go into the future. And I think, and this is where we got to start thinking, right? And yeah. Because the future arrives pretty fast at times, right? Like we were not expecting the future to arrive in December the way it has, right?
I know.
Like, so in 1 4-month period, the whole world is exposed to online grocery delivery. Just like it's become like mainstream behavior. And it's also exposed that, you know, there are two kinds of people. People who can get things brought to them and people who bring things to them. And that's, there is, it's no longer invisible disparity. It's very visible disparity between society. So,
yep.
You know, and that has happened in a constrained period of time. There is going to be a change because of that. There is going to be a need for, you know, a contactless logistics and supply chain where we don't need people, you know, moving things from one place to another. So what does that mean? What does it mean for employment? What does it mean for people's rights? What does it mean for...
do you think it means for automation? Do you think that we're going to have many more robots in factories because you need more space on assembly lines and because people won't be coming into work? Or do you think that actually the introduction of robots will be reduced because now there is considerable unemployment, meaning people will be willing to sort of work for lower wages, companies won't have much money to invest in infrastructure? What's going to happen there?
My near term is that we are not going to see any impact, but in 10 years from now, I think more automation everywhere. Yes, right. It's a little simple thing. I was one of those people who never thought about getting a Roomba device for my house. I got two.
You have two Roombas now?
Because one is for like cleaning and one is for mopping and stuff. So I have two robots.
Yeah.
Right. Never really thought about it as like a robot. I have two robot assistants.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's kind of, and I made that decision in last 4 months.
Uh-huh.
It was not a decision I was going to make because I had somebody who was helping me and it was great. You know, I was appreciative of her efforts and like same thing. It's like, whoa. You know, if we are quarantined for like 5, 6, 7 months and this person can't visit me, I need to do something. I need to kind of figure out, you know, how to do these things. And like a lot of that is going to happen at a larger, you know, at a higher level, like at companies, at hospitals, in the airports. You know, it's like we probably need to have more cleaner requirement, you know, tougher cleaner requirements, not more cleaner, but tougher cleaner requirements. And like, so that means we will have to start augmenting humans with machines, which are more automated. And I think those are the decisions we need to be thinking about. And like, what's the empirical impact of those things on society, people's incomes, but it also is on like, you know, spending and all those things. And they are happening and like they will not. And just like, you know, telemedicine and online education have showed up, we're going to see all those things show up pretty fast as well.
I've been thinking about that where, you know, I've always thought there's kind of a, you know, spectrum of jobs that will be replaced by machines, right? And it's, you know, the first ones will be jobs that do repetitive tasks that don't involve a lot of emotional connection or intuition, right? You can kind of draw a matrix, right? Kai-Fu Lee does a really good job in his book. And, you know, he's got, you know, how intuitive is a job? How much creativity does it require? How social is it? How social is it on the y-axis, creativity on the x-axis? But now it's almost like there's a third axis you need to add, which is how much interaction is there? Because any job that involves a lot of human interaction is one that is more likely to be replaced now. One that's, you know, much harder to do and better to replace with a machine. So a job where you have to go and talk face to face with 20 people is a job that if it could be done by a machine is more likely to be done by a machine. I was thinking about that just this morning in a conversation with somebody about how wired hires, right? And how you think about the journalists you bring in. And 6 months ago, if given two applicants, one of whom is really social and personable and could go to a dinner party and meet everybody and leave the dinner party, having figured out, you know, found a person who has an interesting story that could make for a good Wired piece. Person with that skill set is less valuable now because there are no dinner parties, but a person who can spend 4 hours, you know, going through public data sets looking for something that can make a good Wired story, that person is more valuable because you can do that. And so what's happening with this coronavirus is that with every job, it will add a new variable to the sort of automation matrix and change which jobs are done by humans and which jobs are done by machines.
I think you're right about that. And I hope our friendship doesn't get automated. I have a coffee once in a while. I think I haven't seen you in a bit, and I don't know when I'll see you next. But
well, we usually have coffee outside in South Park, right? And so that's fine.
Yeah, we just won't
be able to go into Blue Bottle together. We'll have to, like, I don't know, we'll go in one at a time, right? As you have like a line with 6 feet out the door.
Yeah. I can't imagine how long the Blue Bottle line is going to be around the block, I guess.
I know. I mean, right. Or, I mean, who the heck knows what's going to happen. But yes, I think we'll be able to sit in South Park. It'll be all right.
Okay. So before, you know, I go, I want to ask you, what are the behaviors you think will stick as it is, you know, that we've experienced over the last 4 months going forward?
Well, I think we're going to, you know, I think that we'll work from home a lot more. We were talking about this, right? I'm up here in the Catskills with my wife and three kids. And, you know, both she and I are able to do our jobs at a pretty good efficiency. So at the very least, like for us, like you can imagine us taking 2 weeks up here when the kids are out of school and doing our jobs up here in a way we never thought was possible beforehand. And I think for lots of people, they'll start working from home full time, they'll start working from home more of the time, right? And so, you know, the need for a city, the need for an office will decline, and that will have huge effects on real estate and all kinds of other stuff. So that will make a difference. That will stay. I hope that the hand washing, you know, cleaning up, right, like wiping down doorknobs, that should probably stay, but who knows? You know, I hope for every, I guess maybe the more interesting thing is, I hope for every person, every single one of us has things that we'd spend more of our time on now than we did before, right? So I spend more of my time playing guitar than I did before this happened because I'm at home a higher percentage of the day and the guitar is right there. Right. I spend more of my time like playing card games with my three sons. Right. We've worked out a really, you know, we spend a lot more time doing family soccer. Right. And there's like, we've all kinds of new routines we've built. And so my hope is that for everybody, there's at least one new valuable routine that was discovered in this moment of crisis that we keep. And so maybe when this is over, maybe like family soccer will stay as a tradition. Maybe the guitar playing will stay. What is it for you?
For me, it's like my life is pretty much the same.
Really?
Yeah, the only thing missing is the coffees with people. Yeah. I actually enjoy their company. Otherwise, I've been working from home, I don't know, since 2007. So this is like normal. You know, I miss seeing people. I miss human interaction. Like, right now it's like, a two-dimensional human interaction is not doing the job. And so that's, you know, I love going out and eating. So that probably is out of the window for now.
Yeah. So come back.
Yeah. But it'll be very much more different than it is right now. Yeah. So, but apart from that, like I definitely believe that there is going to be a need for a whole new way of working interfaces. There's going to be need for, you know, redefining, you know, of actually the taxation rules. It's like, how much do we work from home? And like, how are you thinking about working from home? And it's like, you know, I'm suddenly thinking my tiny studio, one bedroom studio type apartment isn't enough to work from home. I say, if I'm going to do this, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours a day, I definitely need an apartment with a dedicated office space, right?
So yeah.
And so what does that really mean? And like, you know, and all those things definitely are going to be big ideas to explore. I also feel that, you know, the idea of like figuring out, you know, what is the personal time and personal space, you know, would be very, very important. I don't think the current corporate structure is set up to actually have empathy towards employees at all. Like, mm-hmm. It's all about, can you get the project done? And people are very, not very understanding of the other person's time compulsions. And so it's sort of like, though, especially when they're junior people, you know, the senior people have, you gotta get this thing done. And like, that's okay when you're in the office, but now you're going to have to do that when you're, you know, it's like, so you kind of have to start thinking about those things.
Yeah.
But thank you, Nick, for your time.
And thanks for having me here. It's so good it's good to see you.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're out and having fun. So I hope to see you soon.
I hope to. I will, as soon as I'm allowed to go back to San Francisco.